Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Neil Bradbury, PhD. He's a professor of physiology and biophysics at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science, where he teaches and conducts research on genetic diseases. And we're talking about his book, A Taste for Poison, 11 Deadly Molecules and the Killers Who Use Them. Neil, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to talk to you as well.
This is my favorite kind of science book. There's real hard biochemistry and toxicology in this book, but you wouldn't know that you're learning along the way. There's also some great forensic stories in this that are just crazy. What brought you to the biochemistry of poisons?
Well, obviously, I've always been interested in science. I did degrees in biochemistry, so it's part of my academic training. But as I was going through classes as an undergraduate, we did keep kind of mentioning poisons along the way. And interestingly, a lot of scientific developments have been based upon the use of poisons to take out specific components of the body's function. So poisons actually have a long history of being of benefit in medical research. And I was intrigued then as to how poisons were used to actually kill people. And I'd always been interested in the murder mysteries growing up. You know, we always read Agatha Christie and watched detective shows on TV. But I was very disappointed that they often say that people were poisoned with such and such a drug, but never actually described how they died with it. They just said they were dead. And that got me thinking and wanting to delve deeper into actually how these different poisons work in the body, because they work in quite different ways and attack different parts of the body depending upon what the poison is.
Earlier on, you were talking about positive uses of some of these. There's a quote you use in the book. It's the dose that makes the poison. And many times throughout the book, the poison you'd be dealing with is useful in very small doses. So it ends up that it's the amount of it that makes it toxic to us.
That's true for actually quite a lot of poisons. We generally think of poisons as something nasty that any amount's going to kill you. But there are several stories in the book that I go through that show that depending upon how much you use, it can actually be used therapeutically. For example, atropine, when it's used on its own, can cause the heart to race dramatically, and the heart will beat so fast that it starts to become erratic, doesn't work properly, doesn't pump blood around the body, and a person will eventually die from massive heart failure. In contrast, I'm sure many people are familiar with some of the nerve agents that have been used against spies sent out from Russia that have been used to kill, for example, the double agent in Salisbury that was poisoned with nerve agents a few years ago. The antidote for nerve agents is actually atropine. So it can be used to cure and save people's lives, depending upon how it's used and how much is used. And that's true for many different kinds of things, and that we would typically think of poisons when they're used incorrectly and in the wrong amount, but used properly, they can be treatments.
Are the terms poisons and toxins interchangeable?
For the most part, they are. Technically, they're not the same thing. Poisons generally refer to things that are natural. So we think of poisons that come from plants or even poisons that come from the ground like arsenic. Toxins generally are thought of as man-made compounds. So dioxin, nasty things like that would be toxins. But for the most part, they can be used interchangeably. They really refer to any chemical that really upsets and affects the normal functioning of the body.
As you write in the book, in the introduction, poisons can be delivered through several different routes. What are they?
You can get poisoning a lot of different ways. Obviously, a main one is drinking the poison, so poison sprinkled into food or into a glass of wine. That's an easy way to get poisons into the body. But you can also inhale them. So cyanide gas would be one example of a way in which you could inhale the poison. And some poisons can be absorbed directly through the skin. So things like aconite can be absorbed through the skin. Obviously, it takes a little longer for the drugs to get into the body if they have to be absorbed through the skin. But you can get them in several ways, but generally people think about putting poison in food when they're thinking about poisoning.
Before we move on, I just want to mention another point that you make in the book is the chemical itself is not good or bad. It's how we use it. We're the people that make the chemical good or bad. The chemical itself is just a chemical.
It is. And certainly I have in my laboratory, I have chemicals sitting on the shelf that are in a bottle just minding their own business and not doing anybody any harm. But it's the person that uses them. What's the intent of the use? Is it to benefit people or is it to kill people? And that's really the responsibility of the individual using them, not the chemical. The chemical has no intrinsic malice or beneficence in it. It's the person that's using them. Are they using it to benefit people or are they using it for their own advancement by taking out a problem that they consider needs taking out?
The book is divided into two big sections. One is biomolecules of death. And then the second one is molecules of death from the earth. And that would be arsenic would be a good example of that, right?
Arsenic would be a very good example of something that's obtained from the earth. Arsenic's been known for a very long time. And the original history of how arsenic came about was usually something kept very secret and handed down by word of mouth to special individuals. But it is something that is fairly common. It is toxic in large amounts. But surprisingly, we can actually tolerate a certain amount of arsenic.
Well, you had a story in the book that I had never heard of before, of the arsenic eaters.
Yeah, so this goes back to late Victorian times where arsenic was actually thought to be of benefit. So it was included in makeup, so women would powder it on their faces. Back at the time, the idea of having a tan and a nice bronze glow to you was considered not something desirable. And so arsenic was powdered onto their faces. Arsenic was also thought to be of benefit. And so many medications included arsenic, which then led on to the problem of how do you show that someone was murdered with arsenic.
Right.
And that became a huge tool for defense lawyers, saying that the victim does have lots of arsenic in their bodies, but that's because they were an arsenic eater and they were taking it for medicinal purposes. And there really isn't a criminal here that we need to convict. As we now know, arsenic is really not that good for you.
Well, you know what? That's another sort of parallel tale that's told in your book is detecting the poisons. That, you know, back in the 1800s where there were not a lot of tests to test to see if someone was with poison, it sort of seems like a golden age of poisoning because you could get away with a lot because they didn't have sophisticated tests to test to see if the victim was poisoned.
You could get away with a lot, and oftentimes many of the symptoms of poisoning are very similar to diseases that were rampant at the time. So going back to arsenic, for example, the symptoms of arsenic poisoning are very similar to what you would see for cholera. For example, severe sweating, diarrhea, stomach cramps, all of which could be easily mistaken for a disease going round. But as chemists tried to figure out how to detect these chemicals, a lot of these substances that were found from the earth, like arsenic, started to become fairly easy to detect. And so there was a gradual switch away from things like arsenic towards more plant-based poisons that were a lot more difficult to detect. And at the time, there really weren't any good means of detecting those poisons. One of the stories in the book that I do mention it is the bizarre case of a forensics professor who was able to detect poisons by tasting them.
I read that with alarm. I read that with alarm. Go ahead.
You know, you think about, okay, we can taste some poisons and maybe just a little dab on the tongue and you can taste it. But he was actually tasting poisons that were in ground-up stomach contents and intestinal contents that were all ground up. Fortunately, that method for detecting poisons is somewhat grown out of use, and we do now have sophisticated machines that can detect very small amounts of poisons. And so nowadays, it's really hard to get away with any poisoning. It can be detected.
There's some fascinating stories, though, in this book. Under insulin, there was the conviction of Kenneth Barlow, I think it was. And what they did is, it was present, his wife, I think Elizabeth, and they actually took part of her body and injected it into mice and rats and eventually guinea pigs, and then would see if they died. And that was one of the ways to test. And I believe it took 12,000 mice, 90 rats, and several guinea pigs.
It's incredible. There were just not really sophisticated ways of testing for those kind of, obviously, insulin. Again, as we start out the conversation, one of those compounds which is absolutely necessary for life. But if you give too much, then it will kill you. And so you have to be very careful with the amount of insulin that you give to individuals. But at the time, there was no known method of detecting insulin. We knew what the actions of insulin were. And the only way was to take samples of tissue from Elizabeth, his wife, and inject them into mice. And nowadays, we don't do that. Fortunately for the mice, we do have more sophisticated ways of detecting insulin.
And they would sometimes even do that in court, not in a lab. There was a story in your book about a cat that was brought into court and then injected and died.
That's probably one of the earliest cases of forensic science that was presented in a New York court case. This was a man that a doctor in New York who had decided that he would like to marry the local brothel owner and eventually realized that that was not very good for his status in New York society. And so he decided that he was going to kill her, in this case with morphine. Morphine poisoning was known at the time, and there was actually a really good way to detect morphine poisoning victims, in that their pupils are very much pinpoint. The pupils contract, so they're almost non-existent. And that's a characteristic, classic telltale symptom of morphine poisoning. But he, thinking that he was a doctor and much cleverer than anyone else, realized that, again, going back to atropine that we mentioned earlier, that if you took some drops of atropine and dropped them into the eyes, then the pupils would just expand. And this was actually something that's been known for hundreds of years. If you look at paintings from the Italian Renaissance, all the women have large doe eyes, and that's because they've squeezed the juice from the belladonna plant, which contains lots of atropine, so that their eyes expand. And so the doctor decided that, well, I'll do this, and then nobody will be able to figure out that they've got pinpoint pupils, because they won't have, and so I'll get free and clear. And so the prosecution actually brought a cat into the courtroom and killed the cat with morphine, showed the jury the pinpoint eyes of the cat, the whole jury, and then proceeded to drop atropine, and everyone in the jury just watched there aghast as the dead cat's eyes slowly expanded. And he was eventually convicted and sent to the electric chair for the murder of his wife.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Neil Bradbury, PhD. He is professor of physiology and biophysics at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science, where he teaches and conducts research in genetic diseases. And we're talking about his book. It is a really fascinating book, A Taste for Poison, 11 Deadly Molecules and the Killers Who Use Them. Well, while we're on atropine, let's talk about atropine. There's a great chapter on that in this book. And talk about the plant first, deadly nightshade, also known as belladonna. How did it get the name belladonna? That doesn't sound like an appropriate name.
Well, belladonna in Italian means beautiful lady. And this arises from the fact that if you take some of the berries, which are a shiny black berry, and squeeze some of the drops into your eyes, then you're pupils will expand and you will look attractive and alluring. And this is exactly the same phenomena that many romantic restaurants utilize now, not with atropine, obviously, but low light and candles.
Oh, yeah.
So that the
oh, yeah.
Expand, everybody looks attractive. And that was how many of these Italian courtesans found their husbands. unfortunately, it also affects the lenses in the eyes, so you're actually quite blind. You can't focus, and so you may look very alluring, but you have no idea who you're actually attracting, which may not be good for you. And so that's how it got its name. Belladonna was because of the effects on the eyes. And it's even speculated that the Mona Lisa has belladonna put in her eyes to make her more attractive.
And deadly nightshade's a common plant around here. I see it all the time. It's virtually a weed. And again, we're talking about atropine. Now, there's a case story in your book that's fascinating. It's the Edinburgh, Scotland, 1994 story where a lot of people started believing in contaminated tonic water. Let's talk about this as an example.
Yeah, this is another example of someone that has been academically trained and...
And they think that they know better than the police. That's the thing.
They do. Yeah, he decided that he needed to get rid of his wife so that he could move in with his mistress. And in order to divert attention away from himself, he doped several bottles of tonic water with atropine, put them back on the shelves of a local grocery store, and then allowed people to just randomly buy those bottles, take them home, and get fairly ill. And a lot of people were taken to hospital with symptoms of atropine poisoning. He then proceeded to give his wife a drink of gin and tonic that was laced with atropine. One of the characteristics of atropine is that it's very bitter tasting.
Right.
And
right.
Even though the berries are shiny and attractive, accidental poisoning is very hard because it tastes so bitter. No one would ever eat them. You'd spit them out immediately. But if you're in a drink with gin and tonic water, which is naturally a little bit bitter, it kind of masks the taste, or so he thought. And so he even went on TV. He had the police were there, invited him, and he stood there in front of the police and the press saying that he couldn't understand how anyone would be so callous as to put poison in drinks and then allow people in grocery stores to buy the drink, when all the time he was the guilty person that the police were looking for. He eventually did get caught.
Well, wait a minute. I want to slow that up because what was great is he may have thought he was really intelligent, but the amount of atropine that he put in the other bottles was between 11 and 74 milligrams, whereas that in his wife's bottle was 300 milligrams.
A lot more. I'm sure he had planned to throw that bottle away, but the paramedics came a bit sooner than he anticipated.
Wow.
And collected the bottle that otherwise he should have thrown away. And so despite all his planning and scheming, it always comes down to the little things that you forget.
The amazing thing, and you have lots of details in this book about it, all these different stories, his wife defended him while he was on trial. He was convicted. He was only given 12 years in prison, and it was only afterwards that his wife, Alexandra, finally divorced them. And then the coda to this, which blows my mind, is after release, he ended up getting a teaching job at Manchester University in philosophy and medical ethics.
It is kind of bizarre. It's one of those cases that... If you were to read that in a novel, you'd think, oh, well, that's just a nonsensical ending to the story. But it's actually real life. And as they say often, real life is stranger than fiction.
Wow, it's amazing. Now, some of the stories, they're not that old. That story wasn't that old. But they come right back up into contemporary times. And it's fascinating to me about Soviets developing different kinds of poisons. Because they seem to be trying to develop better poisons that are more easier to administer or more cleverly to be administered and not to be able to be detected. There's a case of this person who picked up the poison from a door handle. I think it was Novichok was the poison.
Yeah, that was Novichok. That was Sergei Skripal, who was an ex-KGB agent who defected to the West. And it was decided that he needed to be taken out. And so Novichok poison was spread on the door handle of his front door. It turns out that the Russian agents had actually smuggled it into Britain disguised as a bottle of perfume and had sprayed the drug onto his front door handle so that when he left, unfortunately, with his daughter to go out to lunch, they both touched the door handle and both absorbed Novichok through their skin. It took a little while for it to start working, but both of them were seriously ill. And it's not something that anyone normally encounters in an emergency department. And so there was a lot of confusion as to what was going on. The initial thinking was that they'd taken a drug overdose.
Right,
but
right.
That didn't seem to make any sense until someone realized that it could be nerve agent, nerve poisoning, which time the antidote in this case, the antidote is actually atropine,
which
blocks the action of the Novichok. Both of them did eventually recover thanks to the use of atropine, and both are now hidden somewhere in Britain, looked after by the British security services.
But weren't two other people also affected by the perfume? I think it was Charlie Rowley and Don Sturgis.
Yeah, that's probably one of the saddest aspects of it, that as the poison was brought in this perfume bottle, the agents just dumped it in a trash can and left it there. And somebody picked it up and decided that, hey, we've got this nice bottle of perfume. It looks like a really nice gift for my girlfriend. And so she sprayed it directly onto her skin.
Wow.
So many, many times the amount that the Skripals had received off the door handle. And she did die because there was just so much. There was nothing that could be done for her. And so, sadly, she did end up dying.
Again, what I enjoy about your book is the science that's brought into it. Novichok is what's called, and it's I may be wrong about this, organophosphates, originally developed as pesticides. But then they were developed into all sorts of other nefarious things.
They have been developed another example. So these are organic molecules that contain a phosphorus group in them, which is where they get the name organophosphates. But as you say, yes, they were initially developed as pesticides, but then it was realized that they could be used for getting rid of people as well. So VX gas would be another classic example of that. And these are really very nasty chemicals. They interfere with the normal transmission of signals from nerves throughout the body and essentially send the whole body into overdrive. They cause massive secretions. So think about all your salivary glands being forced to secrete saliva all at once.
Wow.
And what eventually happens is that there is so much fluid secretion, particularly into the lungs, that people essentially die and drown in their own secretions. It's a very nasty way of dying.
What was amazing to me reading all these cases is how many of them seemed so mundane. They're using these exotic poisons to get rid of their wife, usually, because they have a girlfriend. And it just sort of seems so, oh, God, really? You couldn't think of something else to do other than using these horrible poisons. It's just amazing how many people and how many scientists thought that they were going to be smarter than police.
That is disappointing, being a scientist myself.
I know. So don't be tempted.
No, I in fact, when my wife brought up to me the fact that all these poisons were on the history search on the computer, she was very alarmed until I finally showed her that, yes, indeed, I was writing a book, and the agent could confirm that it was not for nefarious purposes.
Wow.
It was for a book.
Wow. My guest tonight has been Neil Bradbury, PhD. He's a professor of physiology and biophysics at the Rosalind Franklin University of Medicine and Science, where he teaches and conducts research on genetic diseases. And we've been talking about his book, which is just a great read, A Taste for Poison, 11 Deadly Molecules and the Killers Who Use Them. Neil, it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope you and your listeners enjoyed the book.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch.